This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
You're listening to Justice, a podcast exploring all areas of the justice system, with me, prison philanthropist and founder of One Small Thing, Edwina Grosvenor.
In this episode, I speak to Pavan Dhaliwal, Chief Executive of Revolving Doors Agency. They work to end the revolving door of crisis and crime. Pavan explained their belief that justice system reform cannot be achieved without the voices of those who have had direct experience of the system themselves.
Hi, I'm Pavan Dhaliwal and I'm the Chief Executive of Revolving Doors.
Can you tell me why Revolving Doors was set up and exactly what it does?
Yep, so our mission is to break the cycle of crisis and crime, and we work specifically with the revolving door group of people. So it's those people who have repeat contact with the criminal justice system, which is largely driven by unmet health and social needs. So this could be a combination of substance misuse, domestic abuse, homelessness, mental ill health. The term that's used commonly around this is multiple disadvantage.
Okay, and is that adults and children or men and women?
Primarily we work with adults, but over the last few years we've been focusing in on young adults as well, on the 18 to 25 group. In terms of our prevention work, we are really aware that a lot of the work is around prevention and needs to begin a lot earlier. So we try to work in partnership with those who are doing that work, because our members tell us that these are really pertinent issues. So I guess the unique thing about revolving doors is the approach that we take to our work. So we work across policy, research, service design, systems change, but all of our work is underpinned by the voices of those with lived experience. So we have a number of forums, regional forums, women's forum, a new generation policing forum, and everything that we do is informed by those voices, because we firmly believe that the best way to achieve systems change and to reform the system is to be informed by the people who have had direct contact themselves.
Yeah, makes sense, doesn't it?
Absolutely makes sense.
It makes you sort of wonder how it was ever done without those voices feeding in, really, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And what that really helps us do as well is focus in on root causes. We know that with our cohort of people, the main drivers for their behaviour are rooted in poverty, discrimination and trauma. And it's far more powerful when you have those voices who are. So, for instance, it's our members themselves who give evidence to select committees, for instance, on behalf of Revolving Doors. They help co-design the research. They conduct the research themselves as well.
Oh, wow.
And so we make sure that in our approach, it's very much embedded in everything that we're doing. And it's interesting, actually, because I think it's probably shifted over the past 5 to 10 years in that now people do acknowledge the value of lived experience voice, whether it's in service design, moving towards around the governance level as well.
Absolutely. I've noticed with my sort of philanthropic background, I guess more and more funders are also now saying, do you have someone with lived experience on your board? How much consultation are you doing with the sort of organisation that I run? So I'm on sort of both sides of the fence, if you like. So I've definitely been hearing that more and more. And it's absolutely right.
Absolutely. And also, I think it changes the way that you work as well. It's around accountability. So we have, as well as our forums that we have, which inform the work that we're doing, we have an internal board as well called the Lived Experience Advisory Panel. And it's so sort of ingrained in the DNA of the organisation. And it really sort of brings to life and reminds you why you're doing the work that you're doing. And so usually every day, every other day, I will meet with one of our members. I mean, at the moment, it's all happening virtually. And that's actually been a really interesting shift as well in terms of thinking about the types of people that you're able to get involved in the organisation and the work, given the fact that, so pre-COVID, there would have been physical meetings. The people that we work with are not people who served a prison sentence 20 years ago and have since, I don't know, done two PhDs and you know, all of that kind of... The people that we work with they're extraordinary people. We normally work with about 40 to 60 people any one time across our forums. But in order to be eligible to join one of our forums, your contact with the system has got to be very recent, within the last 2 years. A lot of our members are currently on probation. They're currently in treatment services. And so there's still a lot of sort of chaotic elements to their lives as well. And the way that we've adapted to working during COVID, what it's meant is that it's much easier for them to get involved in our work as well.
Yeah, and I bet a lot of them who don't maybe like to travel or get on a busy bus or a tube, it's like, oh, I can talk about this from the safety of my home and I don't need to go out because you might be agoraphobic. You know, things can be
difficult.
Absolutely,
yeah. People have got young children and there's lots of stuff going on in people's lives. But if they can actually, you know, we sent all the kit out to all of our members so they can actually just join via Zoom. I mean, of course, it doesn't replace the face-to-face element. And we do really hope that we can get back to some semblance of normality when it comes to sort of just for that sort of human contact and being able to meet each other in person. But in terms of the output and the work that they've done over the past couple of years, it's been absolutely incredible. Like I said, you know, we've had members who in the last year gave evidence to three different select committees, some sitting in their garden, some rolling up ciggies outside their flats, you know. But really being able to sort of speak truth to power and also not being in that really intimidating environment.
Exactly, which scares, you know, CEOs. Scares, you know, people who in a way could be used to being grilled in meeting rooms and all the rest of it.
Absolutely. And they're able to talk about their life experiences if they've deemed that appropriate. But more importantly, what they're able to do is to suggest solutions and talk about what are the elements that could have made a change in their lives. How could a service have been designed or delivered that could have had a greater impact? And like I said, and these are very live issues for them, because they are currently in receipt of the services as well.
So tell me how that sort of fed into a project like, is it New Gen Policing?
Yeah, New Generation Policing. So New Generation Policing is one of the projects that we've been running over the past 3 years. And that's sort of slightly different from the other work that we do, in that we did decide to focus in on young adults and think about what are the sort of bespoke, personalised, trauma-informed services that can be put in pre or at the point of arrest for young people, where, again, we know that the drivers for their contact are around poverty and discrimination and trauma. And so with that, we convened a group of young people. They're called the New Generation Campaigners. So we work with them to design the campaign and for them to become their own advocates around what they think should change in the system. And they designed a campaign, which was Divert, Don't Arrest. And we worked in partnership with police and crime commissioners and police forces. And the inspiration was actually taken from a a model that was developed in the US with the Public Defenders Association, the LEAD model. And we encouraged police forces to design these bespoke services for young people. We're in the sort of final stages now of the evaluations. And we worked with seven forces across the country in order to do this, along with encouraging them to take a specific approach when it came to race discrimination, to take account of socioeconomic factors, so to be led by what the poverty rates were and okay. what the drivers were for, again, particularly for young people.
So how does that work? Because obviously divert, don't arrest. So trying to sort of stop these young people from getting into the system and getting too bogged down. But so could you give me an example of where the police might divert them to, or what that actually looks like?
Yeah, so we published an evidence review about lots of different diversion schemes and what works and what doesn't work. I guess the thing that I really like about the organisation in that we're not scared to say we've tried something and it didn't work. And we know that there's lots of things out there that aren't as effective as others. So what it's actually about looking at what the local need is. And you won't be surprised to hear me say that all roads lead back to funding and
yes.
funding types of services.
What a surprise.
Yes.
And so, and if there's nothing in the community, where do you divert them to?
Absolutely. And police forces and police and crime commissioners who have all the goodwill in the world and say, actually, you know, we absolutely recognise this. We don't want to see this churn of young people. We're picking up the same young people time and time again. But where do we divert them
yeah.
to? The good thing was, is at the beginning of this project, we managed to secure some investment in terms of trying to design some of these services. And we also set up with the Police Foundation the Knowledge Exchange Network, so a community of practice for police officers across the country who meet, I think, bi-monthly to share that good practice and think about what are they doing in their local area. And also, how do you identify those needs when you pick young people up and when you're interacting with them? And how do you then identify which are the best services to divert them to? But time and time again, when you talk to our young people and to the campaigners and the research that we've done around this, it's just a lack of services and activities in an area for young people to get involved in. So this speaks to a much bigger issue. And that ties in with thinking about how do integrated care systems work? How does the levelling up agenda, how is this going to be addressed through that? And also, we have a whole new cohort of police and crime commissioners who were elected in last May, and how will they be addressing these issues? We're going to be doing some work over the next year looking at participatory budgeting of police forces as well, and thinking about, well, what are the steps that need to be taken before you get to a position where you can engage in a process of participatory budgeting, thinking about what do local people think money should be spent on? Where should the funds be diverted?
I always think that's quite an interesting one, because on the one hand, maybe people in a local community are best placed to obviously speak to what matters to them. But do you think that then sometimes skews the issues of what maybe really do need to be tackled? And I guess I'm thinking about, because we all sit in our homes and it might be like, oh, you know, there's a rural crime and the sheds are being broken into and the tractors are being tampered with. And actually, the big problem in that county is sexual violence. But it might not touch Mr. and Mrs. Miggins because they live in a completely different way. So I guess there's a socioeconomic sort of rub in there.
I think there is. And I think that this is why, when approaching this type of pilot and this type of project, it's about making sure that it's very place-based and honing in on that local area and making sure, and this is, like I said, this is all very much being designed and thinking about actually what could work, what doesn't work. It's actually about presenting the reality of what's happening to local people on the ground. So you'll have the wider national media narrative around crime, around law and order. But if you think about the revolving door group of people, you're talking about a group of people who have repeat contact with the criminal justice system. If you think about the short prison sentences, almost half of people in prison are on short prison sentences for low-level offences, mainly related to theft, where the drivers are really clear. When you think about poverty, you think about substance misuse. So you have to then think about, if you hone in on that at a local level, you think, well, okay, so if, for instance, in your local area, there are theft is a big issue, antisocial behaviour is a big issue. So you could think about extra policing in that area. That's one way you could think about it. Or you could think about, okay, so all of these people who have got substance misuse issues, who are living in poverty, who are dealing with childhood trauma, what are the services in place for them? Because over 60% of them end up back in the prison system within a year when they're on short sentences.
Yeah.
So in fact, would you not rather make sure what money diverted to ensure that those services are in place so people can actually get the help that they need, thinking more with that long-term lens on, as opposed to just thinking in the immediate.
Yeah. But then it's interesting, isn't it? If I'm a police and crime commissioner, then I go, obviously, prevention is really important because then there's less of a budgetary sort of squeeze on my police officers and they can be freed up to be doing more of the job that they need to be doing. But then as the police and crime commissioner, I don't want to maybe put my budget into prevention, because if it is a drug problem, is it not then a health budget? And I might be wrong.
No, and there
absolutely seems to be a bit of an issue there. Whose problem is it? And everyone wants to look after their pounds,
yeah,
quite rightly, and it should be spent wisely because it's taxpayers' money. So whose job is it then to deal with the drug issue?
Absolutely. And I think this is where I think there are some real opportunities. We've got some great national initiatives through things like Project ADDA. We've had the national drug strategy that's been released. But it's actually about working out that multi-agency working and thinking about, okay, how can this be treated as a public health issue? And where would the funds come from in order for that to happen? And I know it's still very much in the early stages, but there are the integrated care systems, which are being introduced from April, I think it is. But that is going to be an opportunity, and we'll be piloting, and we'll also be looking into this again at a local level. How are we going to ensure, where is the best practice where the police and crime commissioner is working with the local public health board, who's working with the chief police constable, who's working with the head of the service for drug addiction? Like, how can that actually work? And we have we're working on the Changing Futures program at the moment. And Changing Futures is a program that was introduced by the government following an 8-year big lottery funded program called Fulfilling Lives. And this program is about improving the outcomes for adults experiencing multiple disadvantage. And the interesting thing is it's been piloted across 15 areas across the country. And it's about systems change. And it's about how do agencies work together to ensure good and long-term outcomes for this particular group who create the most churn in the system. And our role within this program is providing the support on the ground to the various areas to make sure that lived experience voice is embedded throughout the program, from its implementation to supporting co-production, to governance, to decision-making, knowing that the only thing that's going to work is taking that person-centred, trauma-informed approach, which thinks long-term. And I think that part of the trap that the agencies fall into, again, some with the best will in the world, is thinking in short-term, sort of almost political cycles.
Yeah, because so I think all our services do end up becoming political, don't they? Because they're sort of run by government, they're funded by government. If government's short term and thinks in election sort of cycles, then of course the public service have to adapt to that. And one minute they're going left, one minute they're going right, one minute they exist, the next minute they don't, and then it all changes again. And as soon as we all know what the language means, it changes again.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is, you know, this is part of the challenge with when people have been talking about like the levelling up agenda, because you think, well, what does levelling up mean? Are we talking about going to, say, pre-2008 levels and then levelling up from there? Because actually, from what I can see at the moment, it's not even touching the sides.
Yeah, what level are we starting from? What level are we trying to reach?
Absolutely, absolutely, because there was services were completely decimated, and those community-based interventions and services on the ground, they're just not there. So I've been in role at Revolving Doors for a year now, and I had just come from working on sort of pandemic response, and I was thinking, one of the things that really struck me about having just stepped into the sector from health and social care, was thinking about how we could take a step back and think about how would we rethink and reset the system as a whole. Because, yes, we continue to do the core work, which is about working to influence the system as it is, and to almost, a lot of the time, it's sort of tinkering at the edges, as well as trying to work on that sort of wholesale systems change. But what if we were to actually just think, okay, if we could reset the entire system, but think about what do we want from it in 20 years' time? What are we working towards when we just shed the political timescales from our heads? How would we reimagine it in that sense? And so, over the next year, we're going to be doing work on this reset project, and it's going to be an opportunity to sort of take a slight step back. And the thinking around this has very much been informed by thinking about how, as a nation, we came out of the Second World War, and how, same, our economy, look at the state of the economy at that point, thinking about public morale at that point as well. And at the end of it, we came out with the Beveridge Report. We came out of it with the creation of the welfare state. And that is absolutely extraordinary. And it makes me think, what happened to our ambition?
Yeah, what are we going to come out of this with?
Absolutely.
What do we need to make sure we come out of this with?
This is it. And so I think, let's not fall into political traps. If the government are not doing that long-term thinking, why don't we do it as a sector? And so I think this is going to be a good opportunity to do that and bring in lots of different voices. At the heart of this will be people with lived experience.
So interesting, because I was what I was thinking about, and often what I talk about in my work around One Small Thing and trauma and all the rest of it, is when I'm talking about criminal justice, I say, well, imagine we're just taking the criminal aspect completely away, because crime and laws and the ability for us to break laws, you know, laws are created by very intelligent people, but really people usually commit crimes. It's either around housing, low socioeconomic sort of situations that people find themselves in, health problems, but health is a health problem. Housing is a housing problem. So, you know, when that all goes wrong, there is a law, and someone is told they've broken that law, so therefore they become a criminal, and therefore they end up in prison and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But imagine if that didn't exist.
Absolutely.
You know, and then you are then focusing back in on the areas, because I do sometimes feel sorry for the criminal justice system, because it's like, then it becomes their budget problem and a capacity problem. But actually, if we turned it around and put more pressure on health. I know it's not a good time to be saying things like, let's put more pressure on health. But do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's like turning the focus back into the areas of where the problems are starting.
Absolutely. I think it's an interesting time to be having these conversations, particularly with the wider public as well. Because if you think about the situation we're in now and where we're heading, if we think about the cost of living rises, we think about how we're going to come out of how we're coming out of the pandemic, we think about the economic impact that's already happened and yet to come, there will be huge swathes of the population who would never have before considered themselves as being on the breadline or being impacted by poverty, because that's for those groups of people over there, who actually will be feeling the pinch and will be feeling the pressure. And that's no different from the people who are currently trapped in these cycles. And so therefore, it's much easier to, at that point, to slip into, whether it's substance misuse, whether it's having a really fragile housing situation. And so I hope that it will be an opportunity for us to have a bit more of a sensible debate about what we want to be as a society and who we want to be and how we want to treat those people who have less than us and whose life experiences are not maybe the same as ours. And so I think it speaks to, I mean, it probably speaks to probably much wider sort of philosophical issues as well. But then why can't we have those conversations?
Absolutely.
Why must we be constantly so reactive to every small thing that the government might be coming out with? And thinking about, okay, how are we going to tackle this? Like, even like something as wide as what is justice? What are people's perceptions and notions of the concept of justice? I've always been really struck by how different countries approach these issues. Why is it so much more acceptable and palatable, say, to a population in a Scandinavian country to have a far more sort of humane penal system as opposed to the law and order type of debates and a narrative that we have here in the UK, when a decision is made through a court of law and then there's constantly scrutiny over sentencing and then calls for more reviews. And it's a much more febrile atmosphere around these issues in this country. And I wonder why that is. And I think that there is, I think it would be good for us as a sector to take the opportunity to really delve deep into those issues, but bring in wider partners, talk to people, former ministers who were at the helm before making decisions, what they now think they would have done differently. One of the things I always find really fascinating is talking to people in police, in probation, from social services, who have come to the end of their careers and they're retiring, because they have a lot to say.
They have a lot to say.
This is it.
And they can often say it. And so it's brilliant.
This
I always enjoy interviewing people when they're either at the end of their term or they've retired.
Absolutely.
Much more interesting.
Absolutely. Because then they'll always sort of start by sort of saying, you know, when I came into this job, this, you know, these were my ambitions and this is why I went into it. And lots of people who work across the system, it's very vocation led. But then the system grinds people down because of the way that it's currently operating. So wouldn't it be good actually to sort of document their experiences and then think about, okay, well, what would be the really big, bold policy solutions to this? And what if we were to present, say, a 20-year plan, as opposed to just thinking, okay, well, what do we want to influence in this next like 3 or 4 year cycle? Which again is necessary to the work that we're doing, and we continue to do that, but also taking a step back as well and thinking, like, so almost setting the agenda ourselves as well.
So when's that piece of work going to start, and when are you hoping to have concluded it, or is it open-ended?
So at the moment, we're hoping to launch it in the next couple of months. We've been talking to lots of partners. We want to get lots of people involved. It will be, you know, I sort of see Revolving Doors as sort of convening this as a project, not the people sort of leading it. It's the whole point. It's got to be collaborative. And we've been talking to our members about it and thinking about, okay, how would our lived experience voices be leading this type of project? What form will it take? So it's very much sort of in the early stages. But we want to sort of think about who do we need from the outset around the table to be doing this work, and we want to make sure that it's completely sort of like a cross-party effort as well, making sure that we're engaging lots of different voices, so it's not just all people singing from the same hymn sheet. Actually, we do want to hear a diversity of voices, because that's also a part of the issue sometimes.
Yeah.
Where it's like, actually,
echo chambers aren't very useful.
No absolutely not, because they have to be reflective of the population as well. And so there will be some people who may fundamentally disagree with, say, Revolving Doors' viewpoint on certain things. Doesn't mean to say that we shouldn't hear what they've got to say. And I think that a project like this is something that where we can actually bring those different voices together.
And then tell me about the work that you've been doing on the police crime sentencing and courts bill. It's a bit of a mouthful.
Yeah. So I guess the so we've been doing quite a lot of work on that, and we've been supporting others who have been also leading on that particular bill. But one of the things that we wanted to try and push through this bill was a presumption against short sentences, because it's been a long-standing campaign area for revolving doors. And again, it's one of these things, it's a no-brainer. Short prison sentences don't work.
Yeah, and the government even know that. And I say the government no matter what colour, no matter what party. Yeah. But yet, I sort of keep thinking, maybe it's me that's sort of slightly lost it. There must be a reason that they always say they know it's not efficient and it's not a good idea yet.
Yeah.
They keep doing it. I just don't understand why.
It creates so much churn and it costs us so much money. And yet,
clogs up the courts, clogs up the police custody suites. It's not effective. It wastes taxpayers' money, yeah. Does not make victims any safer.
Absolutely.
Are there any plus points?
No. And yeah, it is so short-sighted again. And it's so
unfixable.
Yeah.
You know, because on the podcast, I'm always sort of keen to be like, you know, we sort of trudge over all these different problems. But, you know, what keeps me so buoyant is like, well, the solutions are sitting there and the solutions are totally able to be put into action.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, and of course, and this is no sort of, it's not an innovation in law in order to introduce a presumption. Scotland have had it for a decade that they've had a presumption against short sentences. Now, don't get me wrong, it's not some sort of silver bullet solution to this. Remember, it's just a presumption. But in order for a presumption to be effective, you need to invest into community sentences and community interventions.
Ah, oh, I need to be a rub.
So, but also we know that they have far better outcomes, and they actually, you know, and a well-designed community sentence can actually get to the root causes, and so to stop that churn. But they need investment, and I know that there are problem-solving courts up and down the country, and there are pilots, and there has been, in some areas, more investment put into community sentencing. But then there's a piece of work in ensuring that sentencers, judges, magistrates, actually use them as options.
Yeah, they don't always know what exists.
I mean, that does sometimes astound me. But yeah, don't know what exists or might not have confidence in them. But, you know, community, like the drug treatment orders, the mental health treatment orders. I mean, we're doing a lot of work on dual diagnosis, because that also can be problematic, where somebody could only get a mental health treatment order and then be able to treat the substance misuse problem, which is, I mean, absolutely, that doesn't work. I mean, these are not siloed, isolated problems that people have. It's all part of the whole. It's about taking a person-centred approach to these things. But our sentences do need to become far more confident and willing to use community sentences, as opposed to what is actually, it's the short-sighted, easy option is to use custodial sentences.
But then going back to sort of when the probation system was all but decimated, when it was privatised, and we all remember it well, and we all remember it being knowing that it was going to be a catastrophic disaster. Turns out it was the predicted catastrophic disaster. Like, you know, I think even my sort of seven-year-old could have worked that out. But anyway, we are where we are now. But I do feel sorry sometimes for magistrates, because they do kind of go, well, what is, you know, there isn't anything out there. And a lot of magistrates I talk to say, of course, we don't want to send, particularly women who are more at risk in the community. They tend to need like safer, more secure services, maybe because of domestic violence issues, you know, stalkers, pimps, gang lords. Yeah. So magistrates will actually say she is safer going to prison. And that magistrate might actually be right, as opposed to sending a woman to maybe a, you know, an approved premises where there are men who are actually have just come out of prison on sexual offences, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, so there will be those instances. And this is why a really key element as part of all of this are the pre-sentence reports.
Yeah.
So earlier last year, a group of our members formed a probation team scrutinising the regional reducing reoffending plans that the new regional probation directors will be implementing. And one of the things that we were really clear on was about the need for and really a high quality, up to date pre-sentence reports, because it's at that point actually that the sentencer can make a more informed decision, because it should be based on current up-to-date information.
Just quickly explain to our listeners who might not be aware of what a pre-sentence report is and where it sits within the sort of criminal justice framework, if you don't mind.
So the pre-sentence report will be prepared by the probation officer, and it will be it should be a sort of quite comprehensive account of the individual and of their needs, their track record, efforts that they've been making, and with recommendations for what could actually work for that person.
Recommendations to the magistrate. So a magistrate, yes, can walk into work, they pick up their pre-sentence report on an individual who comes before them, and they can almost literally read off the sheet of paper.
Yeah.
And then make the best decision, yeah, for that individual.
And, I mean, I personally believe that there should be a statutory requirement in terms of the information and the level of quality, because if you are able to deprive an individual of their liberty based upon this document, I feel that there should be some sort of gold standard in terms of...
Yeah, you put it like that. Yeah.
Because if it
good idea.
If it hasn't been filled out properly, some of our members have had experiences of the pre-sentence report being 6 months old, and in that time they've made lots of efforts and they've been parts of lots of different schemes in order to try to reform and to recover, and they're not taking into account. I find it extraordinary that there isn't more effort put into this. And, and it is something that I know that the probation service have committed to doing more work on. But it's just something that it's so much, there is so rides much power that rides on this.
And I guess also the probation officer, you know, if I was in that position where a probation officer is writing the pre-sentence report on me before I go before a magistrate for sentencing, you want that probation officer to be able to write well and to be able to put their case across on my behalf really well, and you want them to care.
Yeah.
That's all a bit dicey, isn't it?
It is a bit dicey. And so what I hear a lot from our members is, that relationship is so key, and the probation officer holds an incredible amount of power because they obviously can recall an individual. And one of the things that we have long pushed for is for there to be a key worker, a link worker, who is somebody who has lived experience, who can sort of work alongside the person on probation and the probation officer. But also when it comes to those decisions around potential recall, that is not left to the discretion of this one individual. So over the last year, we've been holding a probation inquiry, which should be published in the next month. And we've spoken to hundreds of people who are on probation as well as probation officers to talk about their experiences. And from the people who are on probation, that's the message that did come out loud and clear around that relationship. And because we've had members who in the course of 1 year can go through 16 different probation officers. I mean, how on earth are you supposed to form a meaningful relationship and really understand a person if there is so much chopping and changing?
Well, exactly. And also there's a lot of pressure on that probation officer because I don't know what the levels are like now, but certainly at one time, and you'll have more up-to-date information, a probation officer could have, 70 people on their books? Yeah, you're nodding. So I don't know what the caseloads are like at the minute, but is it sort of still around that mark?
So it can be.
That's a lot of pre-sentence reports to write.
We are holding the National Probation Service, the new re-nationalised probation service. We're waiting with bated breath in terms of seeing how this actually plays out. The ambition is there. The strategy is the correct one. There's clearly good intent to try to fix what has been a fiasco of the past few years. So as part of how they're looking at workforce, they're also looking at how they're reassessing risk and thinking about workloads, and they are going to have to recruit lots of new people into the probation services. They've committed to making sure that they employ people who have lived experience within the service, and that lived experience voice is actually embedded throughout the probation service as well. So, I mean, our job is to hold them to account and to be constantly scrutinising through our members who are experiencing the probation service in terms of how it's actually working. But the reducing reoffending plans that were published last year, again, they have good ambitions. You know, you'll be pleased to know, like us, that all of them spoke about how they were going to be trauma-informed as a service. What this actually means in reality and how this will play out.
Yeah. It's a different thing.
It's a different thing.
But, you know, baby steps.
baby steps.
And the fact that people are using the language is important, and I think is a beginning. There are mechanisms and frameworks in place. You know, you'll know that my organisation has been sort of spearheading this from a prison point of view for the last sort of 6 years. And what I always say to people is, look, you know, there is a way to work in a trauma-informed way. There is a way to make your institution a trauma-informed institution, but you have to do it. You can't just use the words. And it is very, very obvious when people are just talking about it compared to the people who are doing it. Because I think people also forget there's, to be trauma-informed is to have the knowledge. To be trauma-responsive is to be doing the work. Yeah. You can't just talk about it, you have to do it. And it's, I guess, now getting people to the point, isn't it, where it's like, you have to do it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you have to do it every day, because actually it's also not a destination. It's a cultural change in how you work. It doesn't stop. It's like having a good, healthy diet. Yeah. You know, it carries on.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think
and there
that
is no end.
From our perspective, because we work, our work is concentrated on before people would enter the prison estate and after they've left around resettlement. But, you know, to be truly trauma-informed, the revolving door group of people would never even touch the criminal justice system, because the services would pick them up before they would have the interaction. And so, again, everything goes back to having really good quality community interventions and diversions, so that there is actually very little interaction with what we know is, see, not a very trauma-informed system at the moment. But you're right in that people are talking about it. That in itself is progress.
Right. Yeah.
That's progress. And through the programme that we're doing with Changing Futures, it's coming to our attention that there are some really good pockets of good practice across the country. And I think some of the work that we're doing, we're working in Plymouth, and I think Plymouth has the ambition to be the first trauma-informed city.
Okay, because I think Lancashire wants to be the first trauma-informed county.
Yeah, but you're
getting very competitive, which is what we like to see.
This is good for us, though. Yeah, absolutely. You know, and what we want to do is make sure that we're capturing that good practice and then promoting it out wider. You know, in many senses, and the agendas that we're working on, there's only so much traction that you will get at the national level. And so you have a programme of work, which is that national influencing. But where you can really affect change is on that local level.
Absolutely. Just circling back for a moment to the short sentences, because that's then, of course, feeds into the apparent increase in the prison population that we seem to be going down that
one-way
alley. To disaster.
That that very unfortunate expansion program, which it's sort of
lost for words.
So, I think I'm lost for words just because if you think about the spend of that type of program,
do we know what the spend is?
It's in the billions because it's part of a wider 10-year plan. If you think that money, put that into the Levelling Up program and think about investment into local services.
Take the people on short sentences for those for whom it's appropriate to be in the community, of which there are many,
yeah,
who pose no danger, who pose no risk to society. Take them out, invest in the community,
Yes, that's the really frustrating thing with this. And it's, you know, it's a big infrastructure spend. And I'm sure that there will be elements, because I mean, we know that our prison estate is horrific in many parts. It hasn't been updated for a long time. So that's different. There's a big difference between if the intention was to improve the existing prison estate as opposed to an expansion program where your very clear intention is to, build them and we'll fill them, essentially.
Because there's the other aspect of having to not just fill them with prisoners, but the people have to work in them. We already have a staffing crisis across our prison system, and the young people who are being recruited in, many of whom have no qualifications at all, who are hugely underpaid, are not being able to do the job well enough because, quite frankly, it's horrific. So they're leaving. Yeah. And then, of course, the older lot left when the frontline staff were cut by 40% back when the probation system was privatised. So where they think they're going to carry on getting these people who are up to the job, the important job of being a prison officer, for such low pay in a very dangerous environment, I mean, good luck to them.
Yeah, absolutely. And this speaks to wider sort of staffing crises across different sectors as well. Again, it's that sort of short-termism when it comes to thinking. They go, oh, well, maybe this will get us a few more votes if we say that we're, you know, tough on crime.
Makes a nice headline, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. But not thinking about the long-term consequences for those people who are going to be entering that estate. So there's the clear economic argument against expanding the prison estate. There's the very clear moral argument when we go back to thinking about the drivers of crime and money that should be pumped into interventions that should be put in place to tackle those. And also the issue that's really caught particularly the media attention was around the 500 extra places for women. And I guess the reason that has been so controversial is because it goes against the government's own stated policy in their strategy that they published in 2018, which was to improve and increase community-based interventions for women and to reduce the amount of women going into prison. And so, yeah.
So what do we do with that? Scratch our heads a little bit more.
And if we think about, so the National Audit Office published last week a report looking into that female offender strategy and scrutinising it. And I mean, it was such a damning report. And the government are yet to sort of respond to that, but also are unable to provide a coherent argument or policy or position in response to this goes against your own stated aims as part of your strategy. We know that, so over half of the women in prison are on short prison sentences. Again, we know what the drivers are.
Over 80% in for non-violent crimes.
Yep. I mean, is this really the best place for women? It absolutely isn't. Polling shows
certainly not good for their children.
No.
They get removed into the care system and then often don't recover, don't come out, or end up in the Youth Offenders Institutes, yeah. and then feeding back into the adverse childhood experiences. And yeah. so it goes on.
Yeah, and this is why I go back to that, which I know can be, you know, it can, I don't know, sometimes it sort of makes me wonder, does it feel a bit too sort of navel-gazing, a bit too philosophical, but is this acceptable to us as a society? Is this the type of society that we want to live in, where we know all of the evidence points to, as soon as a child enters the care system, their life outcomes are horrendous? That should fill us all with shame. And yet this is the current situation. And it's no innovation. It's not that it's, oh, this all happened over the past 5-10 years. No, this is a long-standing issue. And why is it beyond the wit of decision makers and policy makers and governments to actually deal with this and actually tackle this issue?
I completely agree. I sort of always say, you know, when people kind of go, God, how can you carry on working in this sort of world? It's so sort of negative. And I'm like, well, look, you know, we've managed to put a man on the moon. We've got space travel. You know, these issues have been the same for a very long time. You know, they're going to carry on being the same for a very long time. The solutions are out there. There's evidence out there. There's research out there. It's just a case of someone being brave enough somewhere to take a punt and start redesigning the systems. Because as you say, going back to your point about the Second World War and the beverage report and what's going to be our thing maybe coming out of this pandemic whenever we end up coming out of it, maybe it will be the fact that things are so broken at the minute and the court systems are so broken and so backlogged. Is this our rock bottom? Is this the point actually that we can turn around and say, look, this is no longer fit for purpose, I'm afraid, after COVID. We need to redesign new systems and we need to start doing it now.
Absolutely. I sincerely hope that that's the point to which we're getting in terms of, I mean, I don't know where the political will is going to come from yet. I don't know who's our modern day beverage.
Next,
what could you
next
think?
Question.
But there's certainly, like, we have far more power and traction as charities working in this sector, but also just as individual citizens. You know, we have, I mean, maybe let's stay away from something like social media, but we do have sort of people power. We can demand change. And changes have come about because the population, the people in a society have demanded that change happen. And so I think we're at a breaking point with lots of different sectors. I guess that, you know, health and social care is the big one that's dominating. But a lot of the issues that we cover and that we're talking about around multiple disadvantage, these are health and social care issues too.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, yeah, so why can't we then view them in the round as part of these wider societal challenges that we need to tackle head on? And so it takes a lot of brave leadership. I completely understand that in order to do that. But actually, we have a long history of brave leadership. And so, again, I don't think it will take that much. I think it will take a few individuals to really sort of take up this mantle after we've started these conversations start the thinking, and then see what type of public appetite there is for tackling these issues as well. And because so many of them are so tied in with poverty, it really is in the interests of the country as a whole to tackle these issues and to tackle them from the root causes.
Absolutely. And it's better to die trying, I guess. Listen, we've covered a lot and my brain's beginning to hurt, but it's been absolutely amazing to sort of philosophically travel around with you and to talk about some of these issues and the stuff that Revolving Doors is working on. So I will watch with interest as these projects sort of take shape. Thank you so much. If anyone's listening and wants to hear more about Revolving Doors, then we will put notes at the bottom of the footnotes in the podcast. And Pavan, thank you so much for being with me today.
Thank you so much.
Links relevant to this episode can be found in the pod notes below. If you enjoyed listening, we would love it if you would subscribe. Also rate, review, and best of all, share this episode. Justice is produced.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
For One Small Thing by the London Podcast Company.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.